excluding for Keith Agrawal, John Kimmich is opposed to Ron Coates, and a number of my students, Rashmish Mishra, specifically with my colleague Kev Abazaji and Pratik Agrawal. So, it's well established from astrophysics cosmology that about 80% of the matter in the universe is not baryons, it's some kind of dark matter. But we still don't know anything about the nature of the particles which make up the dark matter. So, one thing we do know is that stable particles with weak scale masses and weak scale cross sections naturally tend to have the right relic abundance to explain observations. This is called the Wundt miracle. Just about any model you construct with weak scale masses and weak scale cross sections of visible matter will tend to get the right relic abundance. Right. Now, the Wundt dark matter framework is very robust. It shows up in many, many different ways. And the question I want to ask today is it possible to take a model independent approach? And there are two categories, there are two ways of thinking about a model independent approach. The first question, kind of question you can ask is, to what extent is it possible to extract from experiments information about the nature of the WIMPs independent of any specific model? The second question one can ask, are there robust features which are common to large classes of models that could help discover dark matter? If one is addressing the first kind of question, can we extract from experiment information about WIMPs independent of specific WIMP models, it's obvious that you won't be able to make detailed predictions. Right? You will not be able to predict the smuon mass, right, based on some matter. It may not be a supersymmetric model at all. However, it may be possible to ask some of the more basic questions, like what is the mass of the dark matter? What is its spin? And the question I'll focus on today is the dark matter particle its own antiparticle or not? And this kind of question is also possible to ask. That robust features come to last class of all. And I'll talk about the spectrum of photons from dark matter emission, which I claim has some robust features. So these are the two questions I'm going to address in my talk. Even though there are several other questions one can address, and I'm still working on getting related to this, and but I won't talk about that here. So let me come to the first question. So this, you can think of this as two mini talks, one which addresses this question, and the other which is related to photon spectra. Let me first formulate the problem. The CPT theorem says that for every particle in nature, there's an antiparticle with the same mass and same spin, but opposite charges. Now, dark matter is electrically neutral, so at least in principle, it's possible that dark matter is its own antiparticle.
It doesn't have to be electrically neutral. It can have like 10 minus 6.
Okay, that's fine. So at that level, I'm just letting it go. As far as I'm concerned, for the problem of microoptimum to minus 6, is neutral. it's possible that the dark matter, so since it's electrically neutral, it's possible that the dark matter particle is its own antiparticle. So more precisely, so if you take a particle with a given helicity, CPT relates it to a particle with opposite helicity. And at the same time, since it's massive, you can do a Lorentz boost and end up with another particle with opposite helicity. And the question is, are these two particles the same, the one that's related to it, this by CPT, or the other, and the one that's related to it by Lorentz boost? So the question is, to what extent can dark matter experiments tell us about the relationship between these two objects?
The green box. Does that allow for this possibility that a particle is its own antiparticle?
Of course.
There is an antiparticle.
A particle can be its own antiparticle, right? You mean the way it's phrased?
Yeah.
Okay. But I think that is the conventional phrasing of the... Right. So here's the logic of the talk. I'm going to establish an association between theories where the limp nucleon cross-section is dominated by spin-dependent interactions, and theories where the dark matter particle is its own antiparticle. In other words, what I'm going to try and establish is that for theories where the spin-dependent limp nucleon cross-section is much more than the spin-independent limp nucleon cross-section, are associated with the dark matter being its own antiparticle. However, I'm going to tell you right now that if this is true, it doesn't automatically imply that. So the relationship is one way.
Are there any examples of a particle being its own antiparticle if they are not spins?
Maybe for the if neutrinos are Majorana. Yeah. I mean, in principle, yeah, you need a Majorana fermion. No. If a neutrino has a Majorana mass,
it's a mass.
The experiment that's most sensitive to spin-dependent dark matter is actually an ice cube neutrino telescope that is located at the South Pole. So if you
it's a mass-dependent statement, right? Push this to the lower mass.
That's true. That's true. It's a mass-dependent statement. So, but in this conventional WIMP regime, where WIMP really.
Oh, WIMP can depend GV, right? I mean,
that's a stretch. WIMP really means under GV. But okay, fine.
Wow. Okay, energy GV. Energy GV can be, right? But then ice cube would have difficulty.
In the future, at least, ice cube will be able to get there with the
TCO. This is the important thing.
Yeah. Okay. So a signal at ice cube could help establish that the particle is its own antiparticle, based on this logic. Now, the problem is that ice cube is also sensitive to spin-independent interactions. So a priori, if you saw a signal at ice cube, you wouldn't know whether you were seeing spin-dependent or spin-independent interactions. So what I'm going to show is that the limits from direct detection can place a model independent upper bound on the event rate in ice cube from spin-independent interactions. So that will close this loophole. So what I'll show is that direct detection experiments say that you can't see more than a certain number of events in ice cube if the scattering is spin-independent. And therefore, if you see more events than that, then you're seeing spin-dependent interactions. And then by this logic, you're seeing a hint that the particle is its own antiparticle. This is the logic I'm going to try and trace out. This first part. So let me first talk about spin-dependent dark matter candidates. So direct detection experiments are looking for the recoil of a nucleus of a dark matter particle. Instead, at present, they are able to place limits on the Wim nucleon cross-section as a function of the dark matter mass. And the de Broglie wavelength of the incident dark matter particle is much larger than your typical nucleus. So as far as the WIMP is concerned, it sees the nucleus as a single object, with a single charge, mass, and in the non-relativistic limit, the WIMP nucleon interactions fall into two categories. Either the WIMP cares about the spin of the nucleus primarily, in which case we say it's spin-dependent. And if it doesn't, we say the cross-section is spin-independent. And generally, if you look at the limits from direct detection, they are much tighter than on spin-independent interactions than on spin-dependent interactions. And the reason is that for spin-independent interactions, the contributions from the various nucleons add coherently. You can scatter off any of the nucleons, there are many of them, and they add coherently. So you get an effect which is enhanced by the square of the number of nucleons. On the other hand, no matter how big a nucleus is, it tends to have an order one spin, because the spins of nucleons tend to cancel pairwise. So there is no big enhancement like this in the spin-dependent case. So the experiments are more sensitive to, since most experiments are done with big nuclei, the experiments are more sensitive to spin-independent cross-section. So this is a fairly current set of bonds. And the only thing that matters about these two plots for my talk is the units. So this is 10 raised to minus 6 picobonds, and that's picobonds. And that's just to show you that the bonds on spin independent interactions are much tighter. So what I want you to know is I want to classify theories which naturally lead to spin-dependent interactions in matter. Right? Cosmological limits tell you when dark matter is neutron, recurrent DNA, up here 10 raised to minus 6. I'm going to limit renormalizable theories where WIMP nucleon scattering is elastic and arises from an effective operator generated by a tree diagram at parton level. So what that means in practice is that I need to basically consider WIMP quark operators. So at the short distance scale.
But there could be some axiom exchange as well. That could be like spin dependent and p dependent. I mean, you don't have to have.
Well, let me keep going. Let's see. That will include. I'm not assuming contact interactions. I'm just assuming we know what.
No, you do, because this is what m to the power n. It could be a momentum transfer.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, in general, that's true, yeah. But, you know, let me show you the class of theories I'm talking about, and then we can come down to specifics. Okay. So, in this class of theories, WIMP nucleon scattering, you get an effective operator of this form. So M is the mass of the particle mediating the interaction. N is less than or equal to 2. And in general, these bilinears could include derivatives and things like that. Now the cross section is going to depend on the matrix element of the quark bilinear between nuclear states. And using Faraday symmetry, I can pick out the spin dependent kind of terms. So let S represent the spin of the nucleus and V the relative velocity of the WIMP nuclear system. Now S is a pseudo vector and V is a vector. But all the other parameters in the problem are scalars. So if you go back and look at this quark bilinear, it has to be one of these. You can classify the possible bilinears based on its Faraday properties. And you try to construct an object, since the matrix element must have the same parity as the bilinear, you try to construct invariants which have the same parity properties using these objects. And what you find is that, for example, the pseudoscalar, the leading order invariant you write has is S dot V.
I thought it's for gamma 0, gamma 5. If it's the same in our state in terms of energy, then it's usually what is it, divergence of the spin density. You see, you have gamma 5 and gamma 0, gamma 5 the same.
As yeah, that's not a parity. That's because of a parity, gamma 0 doesn't do that. I'm only using parity, I'm not using the full Lorentz group. The parity, those are the same. So just work it out in the non-relativistic limit.
Yeah.
So this is roughly the classification. And now here's where I make the assumption that Maxime pointed out. I'm going to neglect the velocity dependent terms. Okay. I'm assuming the mediator is not too light. And in that case, the velocity is 10 raised to minus 3. So a bunch of terms drop out. And you can see that I'm working to zeroth order in the velocity expansion. So this term is not there, this term is not there, this term is not there, this term is not there. And now the other terms, is Q bar Q and Q bar sigma mu Q. These are terms that survive, even after dropping all the V's. Okay. This term survives and that term survives. Are generated by effects that break chiral symmetry and can naturally be small. They're not necessarily small, they can naturally be small. So I'm going to assume that they are small and I'll check for self-consistency later on.
So you'd expect there to be a mass insertion.
Yeah, that's why they're small.
Yeah, I know, I said what you're saying, but you're saying it doesn't necessarily have to be small. When does it break in its large?
The point is that spin, it depends on the, you know, the point is the competing effects, you know, the spin dependent is usually not very big anyway. If you're comparing, this that Q bar Q, for example, gives rise to spin independent interactions. Uh-huh. And so even though it's mass suppressed, since the, it's, you know, it could still be comparable.
You mean it can be experimentally large, but it's still got the scale of the mass.
Yeah, so in the end it will, yeah, I mean, okay. let me put it this way, it's generally smaller, but no, it has, there's always a mass there.
No, right. you can multiply by that data, you like that. So, can multiply by
yeah. So there is a mass,
let's be serious for a moment.
There is a mass suppression there.
No, okay, good. Yeah. I just didn't know if you were saying it could be broken by some other condensate of some form, which would have a large scale.
I mean, in principle.
In principle, yes, but I didn't know if that's.
In practice, I'm going to.
Okay.
So for spin-dependent interactions to dominate, there's only two terms left once one has made these two assumptions. Then only two terms which survive are Q bar gamma mu gamma phi Q, which gives rise to spin-dependent interactions. And Q bar gamma mu Q, which gives rise to spin-independent interactions. So if you want spin-dependent interactions to dominate, that operator, operators involving that must be present, and operators involving this must be absent. So what are the question is, what are the theories where this naturally happens? So what I'm going to argue now is that the theories where this naturally happens are in general either Majorana fermions or real vector bosons. So basically the dark matter has spin and is its own antiparticle. Let's see why this is. Now, scalar WIMPs, you can trivially check by the operator analysis, they always lead to spin-independent interactions and the velocity going to zero limit. Now, fermionic WIMPs, there are two kinds of operators that lead to scattering. You can either write this or you can write that. People often ask, well, what happens if you have one term with a gamma mu here and a gamma mu, gamma phi is there? You can convince yourselves that that's actually velocity suppressed on either this side or that side. So there are two operators that have no velocity suppression. Now the thing is that for a Majorana fermion, this operator vanishes because chi bar gamma mu chi is zero. So the scattering is automatically spin dependent. For the Dirac case in general, you get both operators. And so usually Dirac fermions give you spin independent interactions, at least comparable to spin dependent ones. Now, suppose you have vector bosons, turns out there's only one, if it's real, there's only one operator that can contribute in the chiral limit, and that's that one, and it gives rise to spin-dependent interactions. If the vector boson is complex, there's one more operator you can write, which is in general present, and so you get both spin-independent and spin-dependent. So you're seeing a pattern here, which is that real particles, other things which are their own antiparticles, are the ones which kind of automatically give you spin-dependent interactions.
So in the Majorana case, what symmetry or fermion number is typically not conserved? You need a Majorana mass.
Right. So the Dirac fermion usually has a charge. Yeah. So you can't write a Majorana mass term. For a Majorana fermion, it has no such charge.
But it originates in some theory.
No, you don't need anything very sophisticated. You can just write down a theory of Mara Fermi. You just can.
It
just
has no interest.
There's nothing to do with supersymmetry. It's just that if you have a wild fermion, one of the mass terms you can write down for that, the simplest thing you can write down is a Majorana mass. Sometimes by charge you are forbidden from writing down a Majorana mass. And then you need another fermion with the opposite charge to write a Dirac mass term. So we didn't end here. We systematically wrote down all the theories where WIMPs scatter off quarks at tree level, and for scalar fermion and vector boson dark matter, and checked whether the operator analysis is constant. Because sometimes you do something with operator analysis, but when you actually do the calculation, you find that particular operator has coefficient zero. Right? So your naive analysis is not actually doesn't actually hold in real life. But we just actually did all the calculations and we convinced ourselves that all the operators are in fact generated. Okay. Except for one case which has a dagger there. In one case, the Dirac fermion, there is one choice of charges where you get purely spin-dependent interactions. And I'll discuss that. But in all the other cases, the operator analysis just goes through. So let's talk about it. In the case of Dirac fermion dark matter with scattering mediated by T-channel vector exchange, you have a Z-prime. There's one specific choice of Z-prime charges which leads to purely spin-dependent scattering. And that's the case where you couple purely to gamma mu gamma 5. Let's say your Dirac fermion just couples to gamma mu gamma 5, then you end up with purely spin-dependent. So can we understand why that particular, what's special about that choice of charges? If the Dirac fermion has theory possesses a symmetry under which you can interchange the particle with its charge conjugate. So Majorana fermion chi is equal to chi c. But if you can find a symmetry for which it interchanges chi and chi c while leaving all the standard model fields invariant, that bad operator that gives rise to spin independent scattering vanishes. So the condition for spin dependence is actually weaker than chi is equal to chi c. If you have an interchange symmetry like this, you can also get spin dependent scattering. So the reason this is possible is there's a set of Z prime charges which admits this symmetry. Now it turns out that a Z prime in that mass range is highly disfavored by experiments. So anything that a spin dependent experiment can probe in the near future is already practically excluded just by Z prime searches. But I want to mention it because in principle it's possible. Suppose the spin dependent experiments got a lot better, then this would come back into play. But it's not relevant for the near future. Now.
Is it just direct production
C prime? Yeah, so a lab, basically.
Yeah, that's
what it's called. Yeah. Is C prime could decay to dark
matter? It's not so easy to hide. You know why? Because you need to generate this operator, so it has to couple
the
quarks.
So C prime should be under 100 GeV.
It has to be a couple of 100 GeV.
But you generate that.
You're missing energy back.
If it's a couple of 100 GeV,
it's probably contact operator bounds, right?
No, it's a couple of 100 GeV with auto one couplings.
Well, then it's not left, then it's going to be spin dependent.
Yes, yeah, that's what I mean. It's
below, you know, 100 GeV or so. You can't buy it, I don't think, that way, right? It's just missing it.
Oh, gamma and missing it?
It's got, no, the point is, when I say a couple of 100 GeV, it must have auto one couplings. So it's not, you know, you have to scale it with the coupling, and it's not
whatever masses and couplings relevant for the direct detection, which would give you a signal at the direct.
Right, that's right. Actually, I'll be thinking more about ice cube, and how far ice cube can reach. But in that range, it's I think all already disfavored. And you might say, well, why doesn't the Z prime just couple to quarks, right? But then, you know, if it just couples to quarks, then you can convince yourself that that 2 bar gamma mu gamma 5 q means it has to couple differently to left and to right quarks. And so then the Higgs has to have a charge under it, otherwise the Yukawa coupling is not invariant. And then positional electrically kicks in. So you have to, you know, you have to bend it a little bit, and you know, maybe you can construct a theory of a different set, you know, third generation is different, something, something. Maybe you can do something, but it's not easy. That's why I say it's a disfavor, I don't say it's excluded. If you were clever, maybe you could find a way around. Now you might say, what about the other mediators? You know, since this seems to be the condition, can't I implement this symmetry with the other mediators? Turns out you can, but there is no simple realization. You need multiple mediators which transform under the symmetry in some way. And so there's no simple realization. This is the only case where there's a very straightforward realization.
There's no symmetry like that in standard model fields.
Yeah, the standard model fields have to be invariant.
I mean, yeah. I'm just saying, there's no analogous symmetry in the standard model.
No, This is charge elongation. Yeah. It's not a symmetry in the standard model. So now we come to the ice cream. So neutrino telescopes are searching for neutrinos coming from dark matter in relation to the sun. What's happening is that dark matter particles collide with the nucleus in the sun, lose energy, and become gravitationally bound. And after a bunch of scatterings, they accumulate in the core of the sun, and then they can pair any late giving rise to neutrinos. And these are the things that you can look for in neutrino telescopes. So now what I want to argue is that the limits from direct detection can be used to place a model-independent bound in the dark matter event rate. And here's the logic. The capture in the sun is occurring through WIMP nucleon scattering. But that's exactly the same thing that you're bounding by direct detection. So you can use the direct detection limit to place an upper bound on the rate at which WIMPs are being captured. And it's exactly the same process. WIMP hits nucleus in the sun gets captured, but WIMPs cannot be hitting nucleons at a bigger rate than given by direct detection. Now, the annihilation rate of dark matter can at most be equal to the capture rate. You can't have more dark matter going out than coming in. So the capture rate is an upper bound on the rate at which WIMPs are annihilating. And so now suppose I take a fixed dark matter mass and you know use the bound from direct detection and assume annihilation into the most neutrino-rich final state. I get an upper limit on the total neutrino event rate. You cannot see more neutrinos than that.
Did you actually, in your whole class of models, also look at the cosmology? Because you can always turn around the left and right.
No, we didn't do that. Right. We didn't do that.
No, so assuming you can always model the human
rate. Right, so here's the thing. So this is the only place where we actually looked at models. Okay. Now, for the second part, this part, I'm not using any of that information. So this part is really stands on its own. There's no model independence here. This is just a statement about spin dependent versus spin independent. This is just blind.
Right. Because in the end, you make an assumption on the annihilation rate.
There's no assumption on the annihilation rate.
Oh, you put it up on
the... Because what happens is that no matter how fast, how big the initial annihilation rate is, it has to be less than the capture rate. And since I have a limit on the capture rate, annihilation rate cannot be more than that. What you're saying, I guess, is that the annihilation rate can determine the relic abundance. Yeah, but as for setting a bound, that's not applicable, right? So that's what you're saying. If I use your information, I can find that the actual annihilation rate may be a tighter constraint once I put in relic abundance. But I haven't put that in. I capture just this process that this comes, hits this, and becomes gravitationally bound. So that's captured. Captured by the sun. Well, spin independent interactions, what I'm going to show you now is that this limit is comparable to the current ice cube. So let's see. So this is the this is the rate in kilometers square per year. You should take that the ice cube is about a kilometer square effective area. This is the dark matter mass. And the current ice cube bound today is about 300. Right? And you can see that if you annihilate to taus, so this is the maximum number of events you can get in ice cube, putting in the current direct detection bound. And you can see that direct detection already tells you that if annihilation is occurring to Z's or W's or Higgs's, ice cube won't see anything. The only way ice cube could see anything today, given direct detection constraints from spin independent, is if it goes to taus or to neutrinos. Everything else is already out of range of ice cube. But still, there is a way. Maybe it's going to neutrinos. I mean, who knows? So spin-independent interactions could still be responsible for generating a signal that ice cube posts the current bound. Annihilation is to the most neutrino-rich final states. But here's the deal, right? The limits from direct detection on spin-independent are expected to improve by two orders of magnitude. When 0 and 100 really gets going, this will improve by two orders of magnitude. And then what's going to happen is that this spin-independent current bound and the event rate is going to go down by two orders of magnitude. There's the ice cube sensitivity in 5 years. And you can see that that ice cube will no longer be sensitive at all to spin-independent interactions. And at that point, if ice cube does see a signal in the next 5 years, you've basically proved that you're seeing spin-dependent interactions. Okay. And by the logic I explained earlier, you're seeing a strong hint that the dark matter particle is its own antiparticle. This is the logic. So you want ice cube to see something, xenon 100 not to see something. Okay. At that point, you're able to say something strong about the intrinsic nature of matter.
But there's some extra assumptions about like quirking and stability and so on, because you can have like spin dependent anything. You scatter due to the up and down quirks, right? When you annihilate, you have to annihilate into bees or something in the sun. Because if you annihilate into up and down quirks, they hegemonize.
No, that's not a
subject.
You see the way the logic
is. Before they
I understand, but you're not understanding my logic. What I'm saying is, if you first have to see something in ice cream.
Okay.
Okay. So that's a given.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not guaranteeing that you
right,
see
okay.
something. You're absolutely right. So here are assumptions that don't affect the result. I only study two-body final states, but it turns out you can look at however many bodies you want because the signal is actually smaller. I ignore annihilation to non-standard model final states, and for the same reason, because of the way the signal scales with energy of the final state particles, the event rate is smaller than for annihilation to neutrinos. I ignore Sommerfeld enhancement of the annihilation rate because the bound depends on the capture rate. I assume the specific value for the halo density, but that affects direct detection and capture rate in the same way, so it factors out. These things in the end turn out not to matter. But there are two assumptions that can change the result. I assume that dark matter is elastic, so if it's inelastic, then all bets are off. The calculation has to be redone. And I assume the specific distribution of dark matter velocities. So if you change the distribution of dark matter velocities, the way things fall into the sun is different and things can change. This is an important assumption. You have to keep that in mind. I don't think you can change things by orders of magnitude necessary to, you know, the xenon 100 will exclude a region for about an order of magnitude. I don't think this can make a huge difference, but I think that is the weakest point in this analysis. And I did not assume the wimp was a term of like in getting this. This is the conclusions for the first part of my talk. So the direct dark matter candidates that naturally lead to primarily spin-dependent interactions with matter based on my assumptions of normalizable theories, etc. The Majorana fermions and real vector bosons. The dark matter particles, its own antiparticles. So this tends to imply that, but the converse is actually not true. Ice cube is currently sensitive to both spin-independent as well as spin-dependent candidates, but as direct detection bounds improve, a spin-independent case will go out of Ice Cube's reach, and at that point, a signal at Ice Cube would be a strong hint that the dark matter is a spin and it is one antiparticle. And even though I'm not going to show this, the region of parameter space where Ice Cube can expect a signal for spin-independent dark matter is actually kinematically accessible to Ice Cube. So if this story is correct, then the LSE would see something. Let me count to four times.
Which LHC? The 7TB LHC?
7TB is for 7TB is probably good enough.
The luminosity is also.
Yeah. I mean.
So it's not like 100 inverse femtobarns sort of
thing. No. And probably a 10 inverse femtobarns with 14TB, you should already begin to see something very similar.
The sun is getting heavier.
The sun is getting heavier, right?
It's negligible.
Negligible.
Yeah. It's counterbalanced by an
radiation
in the center. Right? So it's getting hotter.
The real question I had was, could you imagine this would explain some heat production in the Earth?
In the mass range I'm looking at, you know, the heavier dark matter which Ice Cube is sensitive to, it's probably not a big effect. But I have seen some papers talking about light dark matter. But there's so much dark matter in the sun that it begins to change things. But I haven't looked into it in any detail. People have talked about it. So the dark matter annihilation process will in general include photons. And the photon spectrum typically has both a diffuse and a line component. Now, if you have a renormalizable theory, the dark matter cannot annihilate directly into photons at tree level. Modulo the 10 raised to minus 5, minus 6 charge. So the diffuse spectrum arises in two ways. So you have primary annihilation products that decay, or you have radiation off the primary annihilation product. And the diffuse spectrum has several model-independent features that make it useful for constraining dark matter. Now the line spectrum, on the other hand, it arises from annihilation of dark matter into gamma, gamma, gamma z, gamma Higgs final states at loop level. And that tends to be much more model dependent than the diffuse spectrum.
So what is the model independent feature of the diffuse spectrum? That it has a cutoff?
I'll show you. You'll see. It's actually quite simple. So for all two-body standard model final states except electrons and muons, the spectrum of diffuse photons is dominated by gamma rays that come from decays of the annihilation products after hadronization. So you produce two standard model particles, they hadronize somehow, and then you get a bunch of pions, so the neutral pion goes to two gamma, so you get a ton of photons. And the spectrum of photons is independent of the dark matter spin or the precise form of the couplings. It tends to depend only on the dark matter mass, that's the energy you're injecting into this process. To some extent on the much more limited extent on exactly what final states are there.
Is that because you assume that dark matter mass is so much heavier than ions?
Yeah, basically. In other words, you produce something and it's produced and then it begins to hadronize, and that's happening much later after all the dark matter information has got kind of got washed out. So because it's got so many independent features, you can use it to place a robust bound when annihilation to various two-body standard models. On the other hand, if you annihilate electrons or muons, the photon spectrum is usually dominated by final state radiation. So you go to E plus, E minus, and then you spit out one gamma. And final state radiation is generally dominated by collinear emission. So but there is an assumption here, which is that this process, chi to E plus, E minus, is not blocked for some reason already. This collinear emission assumption is good, provided this process is not blocked for some reason. So there's no extra enhancement from emitting one more gap. There's a part there. but it's not relevant for anything else I'll say later. The spectrum arising from final state radiation is then independent of the dark matter spin and couplings. It depends only on the dark matter mass and spin and mass of the final state. And so you can get robust boundary annihilation into electronic final states. And there are some other effects, like, you know, which are astrophysical, like inverse Compton scattering of the CLB and starlight. And when you're actually putting bounds, those things can also matter. But that has less to do with this. Okay, so this is the spectrum of photons you get from dark matter annihilating into Bs. This is the dark matter mass is 100 GeV. And these are the energies of the photons. And you can see it begins to cut off very steeply, at around 40 GeV or something. It begins to fall very quickly. So this is the spectrum. And to see that it's kind of got model independent features. This is W's. Annihilation into W's. And you can see that if I flip it very, very quickly, you'd barely be able to tell the difference between annihilating into B's and annihilating into W's. And that's what I mean by model independent feature. Because it's hadronization that's determining the spectrum of photons. And once you've given me the injection energy and told me it hadronizes, then I can kind of tell you the spectrum, independent of exactly how you got those points. On the other hand, if you annihilate to E's, this is the kind of spectrum of photons you get. And it looks very different from the, actually it's very different from the W's. This one is more peaked that way, from this axis matter. It's more peaked this way than the other. All right, currently the most sensitive gamma ray telescopes are Fermi and Hess. Currently, neither of these experiments sees an excess. So you can only place limits. And the strength of the limit depends on the dark matter density profile close to the middle of the galaxy. So this is what, if you're a theorist, you don't like, because there's some uncertainty in the profiles of dark matter close to the middle of the galaxy. So you can always ask, how robust are any bounds I get from that? Right. Now, here's the thing that I think I never appreciated until I worked on this project. So, if you make conservative assumptions about the halos of dark matter, and instead of looking towards the galactic center, you look away from the galactic center, you look at the diffuse gamma rays, your point looking away from the galactic center completely, the isotropic gamma ray flux is dominated by dark matter, the contribution of dark matter in our own galaxy. So, you're looking out into outer space, and you might think, I'm seeing the dark matter annihilating in distant galaxies. But that contribution is actually less than the contribution of dark matter in our own galaxy, just because the dark matter is in our own galaxy is so much closer to us.
So if it decays, then it's even better, even more.
Yeah, right. You can get a stronger bond if it decays. But even for annihilation, it turns out that helps you. If you make an aggressive assumption about the dark matter halo, in other words, you assume that the middle of galaxies' dark matter is very peaked, then the isochromic gamma ray flux depends on distant galaxies. But if you're maximally conservative, our own galaxy wins. Yeah. And the thing is that we know much better the distribution of dark matter away from the galactic center. We can actually simulate in that region consistently. And we don't have to use these extrapolations to the middle of the galaxy and things like that. So this is something we can model, and we can model fairly well. And this allows you to place a conservative limit that is insensitive to the exact form of dark matter close to the galactic center. So what do the limits look like? This is Fermi, and I'm basically concentrating on Fermi because that's the one that gives you the diffuse bounds. And you can see this is the thermal limit. And you can see you're off by a little bit at low dark matter masses, and you start getting further away at higher dark matter masses. So ideally, you would want this to touch this, but it's we're not there yet. Now there is one model dependent feature. In putting this bound, we use the boost factor of 7. Now, if you if you're a very conservative guy, you can argue with that and say, oh, that's too much. But that, I claim, is the only thing one can really argue with in these bounds. If you don't like this bound, reduce it by a factor of 7. But that's the only thing that one can argue with. There's nothing in there that's free apart from that. So, but nevertheless, the current limits are not quite sensitive to thermal dark matter, except in maybe the light mass range. And to improve these bounds, you need a better understanding of the backgrounds, which might be something like blazars. You have to remove point sources and remove the point sources, you know, that today look like diffuse, that part of the diffuse emission. You can remove them, then your backgrounds are less, and you can pick
how
up.
Well, can you hope to subtract the background? So,
one order of magnitude, according to Kim.
One order of magnitude.
According to Kim. He thinks 90% of it is blazars. But
which is going to be touching.
Yeah, just about touching it. So it will be good for light dark matters, but maybe the...
And how much more statistics would Fermi get?
Probably more than that. I should tell you one other thing. So this is the most conservative thing, where you look maximally away from the middle of the galaxy. What Kev says is, let's say I trust all the way to the region where I can do numerical simulations, which is not the middle of the galaxy, but somewhere closer than, you know, completely away from the galactic center. Then he says you can improve this bound by a factor of 5. Okay. So in the best case scenario, you multiply by 5, multiply by 10, and maybe you're in business. So that's kind of where we are. So maybe gamma rays can already constrain certain models. There's a model with a light scalar singlet. You know a lot about this model that has been invoked to explain gamma coagent CDMS. This is the CDMS. The reason they explain CDMS, so there's gamma and gamma. I mean, this is with channeling, without channeling, or something like that. And that's coagent. And maybe if you don't look too carefully, maybe they all fit on a line, you know. And already the constraint kind of...
So why is it two gamma regions, like with channeling, no channeling?
Yeah, that's right. Because the thing is...
50% chance.
Exactly. So the point is, if you choose the right amount of channeling, maybe you can make them all.
Yeah, so I was just not getting it. So, okay. Right. I mean, so wouldn't you just cover all this area between these two blocks, no?
I think those are two different guys arguing about how much channeling there should
be. But if we have third party and saying, well, well, maybe you're 50% right and you're 50% right. Right in the middle, what?
That's
right.
You're
still ruled out.
So, of course, Xenon 10 already claims to have ruled out everything anyway, but it's a different matter. The point is that if you believe that Fermi will get better and the blazars will be removed, then Fermi would be able to exclude it independently of Xenon.
Independently? Well, it's still our model. In this model. Oh.
Yeah, in this model. This is just this specific model.
Yeah. So it's just the Higgs mediated.
That's right, exactly. The scalar singlet.
Yeah.
Right, let me come to gamma ray lines. Now, the strengths of gamma ray lines, on the other hand, are highly model dependent. They actually depend on the detailed form of the matrix element, are very sensitive to new physics running the loop, not just the annihilation products. And very often, the new physics dominates. Now, what I want to show you is that for a given dark matter mass and spin, you can use unitarity relations to place lower bounds of the strengths of gamma ray lines relative to the diffuse spectrum if annihilation is primarily to a single standard model species. If annihilation is to many standard model species, then the limits will be approximate. So I'll focus on theories where the diffuse gamma rays are produced at tree level, from annihilation into a two-body standard model final state. The monochromatic gamma rays come at one loop. So this is a subclass of theories. And in general, both standard model and new physics can run in the loop. And even though I could do gamma z or gamma Higgs, I'm going to stick to gamma gamma. So here's the unitarity relation, S dagger S is 1. And for the transition matrix, that becomes this relation. Now I'm going to work in a basis which simplifies things a lot. I'll work in the angular momentum basis in the center mass frame. And then the two-body state is completely specified by the total energy, the angular momentum quantum numbers, J, M, L, and S, and internal quantum numbers of the two particles. That's enough to specify the state. So now if I take the matrix element between initial and final state, the initial state I has two dark matter particles, and the final state F is gamma gamma, and I stick it in here, and this sum is over all the possible final states that the dark matter can annihilate into. Now, J and M are conserved quantum numbers, as is the total energy. So this sum is over all the species and over all values of L and S. Now, there's a small simplification if the theory respects time reversal invariance. That T minus T dagger becomes the imaginary part of T, and that I is not there. Now, if annihilation is primarily to a single standard model species, and furthermore, the state is characterized by a fixed LMS, there's an assumption I'll come back to. Assume annihilation, say, entirely to Ws or entirely to tops or something. It's to a single standard model final state, and that state is fixed, characterized by fixed LMS, then this sum disappears. And I can take the square of both sides, and I end up with this relation.
So you're getting fixed L and S because you assume, for example, S wave, and then out of if these are fermions.
I'll show you one specific example, and you'll see how it works. Strictly speaking, I can only assume S wave in the initial state. The final state doesn't have to be S wave. So it'll need a careful check to see what's allowed and what's not allowed. I'll use a combination of angular momentum conservation and CP invariance to show you what's allowed. So this leads to a lower bound on the cross-section to two photons. See, the thing is that this is the imaginary, is the contribution to the it's related to the contribution of the imaginary part of the amplitude for annihilation to gamma-gamma. This is the cross-section for, this is the cross-section for the excess to go to gamma-gamma. And this is the cross section for the dark matter to annihilate to the excess. And there are some phase space factors here. So the dark matter cross section to two photons divided by the dark matter cross section to the standard model is greater than a phase space factor times something I can calculate in the standard model. What that means is that I'm getting a lower bound on the line strength relative to the continuum. And I want to come to this assumption I made that only one value of L and S contribute. How realistic is that? That turns out to depend on the dark matter spin and annihilation mode. And it also depends on whether we are talking about a real particle or a complex particle. So let's take the example of Majorana fermion dark matter. Dark matter is non-relativistic, so initially L is zero, and so J depends on the initial spin. But it's a Majorana fermion, so they are identical particles in the initial state. So the wave function has to be totally anti-symmetric. So S has to be zero, and that means that J has to be zero. So now consider annihilations to two photons through a top and anti-top. Now, the top and anti-top can either have L is equal to S is equal to 1 or L is equal to S is equal to 0. However, if I assume that CP is conserved in the annihilation process, then this is forbidden. And so then I have an unique intermediate state, which is L is equal to S is equal to 0. And so then I can push it all the way through and get a bound. Now assume that annihilation goes through W plus W minus. Now there are three possible intermediate states. But only one of these is allowed by CP. And once again, I have an unique intermediate state and I can push through the calculation. But in some cases, there are multiple values of S and L and S are allowed. So you have to go to some specific kinematic region where you can argue that one of the possible states is not allowed. And
better why S can be zero from my own
person. Why S has to be zero from my own? It's for two.
It's two.
Yeah, so it's the initial state of the dark matter.
It's a total spin.
The total spin of the initial state. So there's two Majorana fermions coming in. Each has spin half. So the combination could be one or zero. But only zero is allowed because the wave function is anti-symmetric. So bound can only be obtained in specific kinematic ways. Right, so then how does one actually do this kind of a calculation? There's a way to simplify it. You can map it into the decay of a boson phi with spin j and the appropriate CP properties. And if the intermediate state is unique, this, you can prove that this mapping is exact. And for example, you can do these calculations. And for example, this is a kind of typical answer that you get. The imaginary part of the cross-section to gamma-gamma divided by the cross-section to WW is this quantity, which depends on the only on the velocity of the W boson in the intermediate state, which is a function of the dark matter mass and the W mass. These are kinds of
there's only one
what?
Majorana.
Okay, that phi is not a Majorana. That phi is this scalar. Okay, so I've mapped, these are two Majorana fermions. So this is a calculation. The reason that this calculation is difficult is you don't know these vertices. Okay. You don't know what these vertices are. They're completely unknown. But I've mapped it into this problem where I claim that this ratio is independent of the form of that vertex. Whatever that vertex is, this ratio is independent of that. So I just choose to map the problem into the decay of a scalar. And I choose the vertex how I like for convenience. Okay. And what I'm telling you is that scalar is this scalar here. Okay. That's why. So really, so this is equal to this. That's what I mean. So this is the kind of line strength you get. So this is the Fermi bound. And this is the WW diffuse. And you see a line of this much strength. And this is not really relevant because the limits on lines are different from the limits on diffuse. But it's still, as you can see from the naive scaling, your guess would be that the line is not as strong as the constraint from the diffuse. And that's actually true. It's weaker by a factor of P. And similarly for BB bar, the line is smaller. The Fermi limits on dark matter emission from lines are weaker than the diffuse limits by factors of a few. But there are some special cases which we are still working through where lines may end up giving a stronger bound. Since the backgrounds from lines are longer, you can look for lines in the galactic center. So in that sense, they're complementary to the diffuse bounds. Now, of course, when you're putting lower limits and using fairly conservative assumptions about the dark matter profile, the actual line strength could be many orders of magnitude stronger. So I think what I take away from here is that the discovery potential is there in lines. I think lines are not as good as diffuse in putting bounds, but in terms of discovery, I think lines may play a role. Now the bounds on lines, unlike the diffuse, are actually statistics limited. And so as time goes on, these bounds will get better. So just to show you how this stacks up. You can take the dark matter to be a scalar, a Majorana fermion, a Dirac fermion, a vector boson, and then these are the possible initial spins. And for example, the real vector bosons could annihilate in the J is equal to 2 channel, or the J is equal to 0, etc. And then you can go and see how often you get a unique L and S in the intermediate state. And Then you, every time you see a check mark, that's good. That means there's a unique intermediate state, you can apply the bound. In other cases where you don't see a check mark, you see something like you can get a bound in various kinematic limits. That's also not too bad, because you expect that they're either, unless you tune the dark matter mass to be close to the mass dimension point, they expect either to be not too far from the ultra-relativistic or the non-relativistic regime. So most of them are okay. Recently we did the ultra-relativistic here, I haven't put it up. So the only bad one is the Dirac fermion, because if a Dirac fermion annihilates from J is equal to 1, you can prove using the Landau-Yang theorem that there, you never go to gamma-gamma. So there's a theorem that tells you will never get gamma-gamma in this case. So if dark matter is a Dirac fermion, in principle, you cannot get a robust bound from gamma-gamma. If you want a robust bound on lines, you have to use gamma-z or gamma-higgs, for which the theorem does not apply. So let me wind up the second part of my talk. So diffuse photon spectrum from dark matter annihilation is not sensitive to the dark matter spin or to the form of its couplings. It generally depends only on the dark matter mass and on the annihilation products. With conservative assumptions about the dark matter halos, the isotropic diffuse gamma ray flux is most sensitive to dark matter in our own galaxy. So that allows you to place robust model-independent constraints on the rate of annihilation. The current limits are not quite sensitive to the thermal dark matter, except maybe in the very light mass range, but already able to constrain certain new physics scenarios, which, you know, for various reasons, have larger annihilation to gamma-gamma. To diffuse photons. And the last part of my talk, I showed that unitarity can be used to place model-independent lower bounds on the strengths of gamma-ray lines from dark matter annihilation. Limits depend on the dark matter spin and charge conjugation properties, and also the primary conjugation. So that's it.
What's your favorite dark matter one?
I don't have one. That's why I did this. I don't have a horse in this game. maybe.
Could you say a little more about the LHC reach, like what's actually a cross section?
I'll just give you. This is for a talk I gave earlier. Just to show you, suppose you see a signal in ice cube from spin dependent interactions. Mm-hmm. What it tells you about the masses of particles. You can look at this plot and read off the cases where you get spin-dependent interactions and see what the quantum numbers of the various states are. For example, this gives you spin-dependent interactions, and there you seem to be exchanging a Z, right? Or a Z prime, maybe. And these give you spin-dependent interactions, and there you're exchanging a colored particle. You can kind of go and look, okay, what's the mass of that colored particle for me to see a signal, right, at ice cube, assuming order one couplings. And so here's what you, here's kind of what you see. You can see that the colored states are all in the, There's no region of parameter space where it's more than about a TeV. So phi, q, and x, these three guys are always lighter than 1.2 TeV in almost all of parameter space. So that's pretty good for LHC reach. I'm just thinking of Jay Wacker's recent papers. He says that even with early LHC, this is probably doable. And this is the ice cube five year reach. So it's if ice cube sees something tomorrow, it will even be lower than this.
And these can be singly produced.
No, I think they have to be pair produced because it's dark. Yeah, because it's dark matter, it has a parity.
Then you're in trouble. A little bit.
Really?
Well, for each, like
but you know, that's not so different from SUSY, right?
In trouble there too.
No,
at least for a couple of years.
Couple of years.
Which LHC are you talking about?
The
one currently operating? Or
here's what I did. Telling those friends of mine. At 14 TeV.
Well, 14 TeV, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But 7 TeV, they're producing things that are about a TeV is hard.
Yeah.
Very hard.
Yeah, but here's the way I see it. That's a bound, right? That is a bound. And assuming an order one coupling, right? Mm-hmm. Now, most of the couplings we see in nature are not order one. So if you make it smaller, this is going to go down, right? So most folks, if you ask where is most of the parameter space, it's probably around here, 600, 700 GeV. That's where most of the parameter space is. And so, yeah. So what, the way I think about it is that if this story is correct, we will know. Okay? We will see it in ice cream. And then we will confirm that at the LHC. It might not be happening overnight, but it will happen.
Is this ice cube, deep core already in place?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure. If they have put it in, they put it in a few this last time. It's not in before that. I should actually check up about that. But yeah, but it's set to happen. It will happen.
My colleague. Victor Zajac claims that Picasso has the world record of a spin dependent.
That might well be true. Yeah, so let me explain why that is. It's because
but Picasso by definition only Zajac was supposed to
be. Is he just exaggerating his prowess or does he have a bad publicist?
When publicists, in the 90s when they started, right, nobody talked to them. Any other candidates other than neutralinos, right? And neutralinos had to be 70 GeV or heavier, right? So they didn't even understand that they had, at that time, didn't understand that they have a much better sensitivity to all various other candidates that are lighter, right?
Yeah. What I think is, I just randomly picked two which seem to be among the strongest. And Picasso is in the ball game somewhere here. But the point is that
I think it's also the composition of the spin, whether it's proton dominated or neutron dominated. So is this one maybe neutron dominated or I don't know. We can think of any isotopic composition of that depending on which nucleus you use. So.
Yeah, the way I think about it is that this is a million times stronger than that, right? But I already showed you that Ice Cube is competitive with this, right? So that means that, and even for spin dependent, Ice Cube is not too far away from here. So Ice Cube is actually four orders of magnitude stronger than any of these guys. Now, on the other hand, there's one important thing you got to keep in mind, which is that Ice Cube, as Maxim actually said, suppose the annihilation is to something like electrons or muons, things that get stopped in the sun and don't give you neutrinos, then Ice Cube won't see it. So Ice Cube is not so useful for putting bounds. It's better for discovery. These can put robust bounds, but Ice Cube, it's hard to put a robust bound without giving additional information about what you annihilate to. But since I'm interested in discovery of spin dependent, that's why I'm concentrating on Ice Cube, because I believe it has more scope. That's why I didn't spend much time on the spin-dependent experiments.
How do the monojet atoms independent, do they change the story at all with Ice Cube? Because I know that for some masses they're more sensitive.
You know what, I don't like those collider circuits, because they always have to assume something about the kinematic region, you know what I mean? In other words, you know, you're taking a point interaction of some sort, and assuming it's valid to higher energies or something. But if there's some new state that comes into play there, then there's kinematic cuts that come in.
Sure.
And that changes the high energy behavior, right? You're trying to put a bound at an energy exchange of 10 keV. and we bound it using a collider experiment at, you know.
If the scale is high enough, suppressing this out there, that particle.
That I
still disagree with that.
I mean, I do.
That, I agree. Then, if the scale suppressing operator is, you know, below the weak scale.
Yeah, but here's the thing. But for the current bounds,
yeah,
the scale of that operator is very low, because the spin dependent bounds are so weak. This is a ridiculously weak bound. So if I take this, because of the ridiculously weak bound, the scale of that operator becomes very low, and then that assumption begins to hurt you. You see what I mean? So that's what I'm queasy about it, you know. On the other hand, if they were to do the same thing for this, where the scales are higher, maybe I would feel better, because I can believe that, okay, you actually...
Yeah, in that case, it's not as sensitive.
Right. Exactly. But you see, it's kind of, you can't win which way, right?
Living off danger.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know exactly what to say. I mean, I would prefer it if the analysis were done kind of the way I did this one. For example, if people were to do it the way I did this, just write down the possible tree-level diagrams, and then put the bound diagram by diagram, right? And then at least you're consistently accounting for all the possible intermediate states at tree level, and put the bound on the case-by-case basis. That I would buy.
I think people are doing that.
Is that right? Okay, yeah. Right. That I would buy. What I don't like is this point interaction. Nobody understands where the cuts are coming in.
I've heard that complaint from you.
Is that right? Okay. I'm not the only person yelling in the wilderness.
Well, there's many of these papers that I believe also praise, like the one on the end of that digging and the stand on the Higgs mediation is not including this edges at all. What about this axiom mediation? I suppose I have Susan
Trolino. You know, the thing is, on line one, I made this assumption.
Yeah.
Okay. And that,
more generally, what are there more kind of physics signatures to be opened up or something? You know, like if your mediator is. I mean, people have played, including us, like reactors and light scalers. A bit in the light, so the scale is super, but maybe you can get completely normal signature like neutralino or whatever wimp is now leaking into that, right? And this thing travels and converts to noise in non neutralino, right? Some completely new things.
Yeah.
There was a paper recently.
Was there?
That's the way I saw
it. On the axioms?
Yeah, following up what we did. Not this, I don't know axioms, but neutrino signals from mediators.
No, but what I meant is that you annihilate them to axioms, suppose it's your wimp annihilation channel, spin channel, you go straight to the axiom, go past neutrino, and then the axiom converts into an isotope and produces. It's hard to produce a pair of new ones, but in the super K, it will produce like an electron like event because it converts to a closed pair.
Yeah. I mean, that scenario I don't think is very likely because it's unlikely that it will convert exactly in ICP, right? Because if there's so much play, the probability that it converts exactly in ICP is very small.
What I meant is that I can always have a wimp that annihilates into a masses or nearly masses axis.
Right.
And we know that the scale of the interaction should be 1 over TV or something, and we'll take care of the abundance issue, right? Then I could have a small coupling to a quark, electron, or through better be, you know, like consistent with whatever is pulling them.
Right.
But I could still have that, right? So I can have a capture in the sun, annihilation into the vacuums, could have a spin dependence gathering, I could have, instead of a neutrino signal, just straight axiom converting into a state pair of
Well, even to a faucet, for example, right? In the field of the nucleus, converting into a photon and producing a very hard gamma in the super K that will be picked up by you know, kind of basically not separating the
electron. So why should it be an atom? It can be anything state.
Yeah, I guess so. We're playing with decaying stuff. Accident, just because there was a discussion about spin dependent thing, right? Is a scenario spin dependent.
When I think of discovering ice cube, I'm just thinking of this conventional scenario, how they look for muons arising from neutrinos. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they could get, in principle, you're right, they could discover something more exotic, right?
Well, they can run unless they look for the signal.
they mostly look for muons because that travels the furthest, it gives a nice line.
Right. Yeah. It's probably super okay, though.
Right. But the ice cube triggers are pretty, especially in the beginning, they're pretty tight. You know, they throw out anything that doesn't really.
Are they sensitive at all to electron?
It doesn't travel far enough.
No.
They have some sensitivity to taus, but only if the tau decays inside them.
And produces a muon.
You are maybe even an electron. It kind of looks like a band in their. Which they can see. I don't think they're sensitive to electrons. They are looking for taus. There is some sensitivity there, but mostly they're sensitive to muons. And their cuts on what they consider a muon are pretty tight. They have to see it in several of these.
And then this model, if you are now into two axions, mm-hmm. right, and let's say they're nearly massless, so they decay into two gammas that are nearly collinear, right? It's a question whether what? I mean, they will make
it's a little pathological.
Why? Not more pathological than anything else. Exactly the same thing. Not that. Not worse.
Statement.
No, absolutely the same thing. I'm sorry. If somebody tells you that he or she knows what dark matter is, this is just total bogus, right? And all bets are off the table. As long as I'm fulfilling the annihilation, the win premise, right? It annihilates with the same rate, right? So it gives the same one. What's wrong with that, right? It will correct for the deficit of the neutrino when we see that n equals roughly 4, so I'll get the 4 neutrino states. In cosmology, because of energy density and that stuff, because it will be, experimental. Why is it pathological? No, no more pathological than anything else.
Right. I guess it is probably a good point maybe to stop the discussion. Maybe continue that in my GGs. Let's thank Chuck again.
Why would you say that?
It's a little complicated.
No.